Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and a simple question. Are you going to let your kids wear masks in school come the fall? Are you going to send your kid back to a school where masks are mandatory? Are you engaged in any dialogue with your school district as it pertains to mask wearing come the fall?
312-642-5600, turnkey DEPRO, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Before you answer that question, you, Amy, you and the listening audience as well, take this 10-year-old girl's testimony. Gracia Livy's daughter in Naperville District 203, who had this to say to her school board recently. Boy, a lot of smart kids in 203. I wish some would maybe even in their pre-adolescence run for school board.
The elementary. I have watched my mom come and speak at these meetings. I hope that you will speak to the people in charge about having kids wear masks all day long. My sister Lila has a disability, and it is hard for people to understand her. She goes to Ann Reed. We try to understand what she is saying by looking at her lips, but it's hard when she is masked and it seems like she talks less. It seems like an unfair advantage to have her mouth covered when she is learning to say all of her sounds. If we do masks another year, I think it'll be extra hard for her to have her lips covered and her teacher's lips covered. My brother Ben is in second grade, and he doesn't mind wearing the masks, but I do. Sometimes it's hard to tell when someone is upset at you or interested in talking to you. With a mask, they may look like they don't want to talk to you, but if I could see the smile on their face, then it would be easier to know if they want to play. When I'm doing math work and I'm trying to concentrate, I really notice my mask. It is distracting me and it just bugs me. I feel like sometimes I can't get full breaths and have to pull it down, even though we are not supposed to. Some days we don't get mask breaks. When we come inside from recess and we've been running around, it's really not a good feeling to go back to school and try concentrate with the mask on because my mask is hot and sweaty. Another thing I notice is kids who are quieter just don't bother talking in class as much. We won't be able to understand some of my classmates, and the teacher says, "Sorry, I can't hear you. You need to say it again." After a while, it feels like it would just be easier to not raise your hand because you know everyone can't understand you anyways. Another thing that doesn't make sense is that we don't have to wear masks when we are outside on the weekends with friends playing soccer or swimming. But at school, it's not safe at recess. I'm also going to summer camp this summer, which I'm excited about. And I don't have to wear them at summer camp. Summer camp is a lot like school. You are with the same friends every day, inside and outside. Why is that okay? But school is not. Do the teachers want us all to wear masks all the time? If you don't agree with the state of Illinois, will you speak up for us?
On behalf of the whole board, thank you for your
Thank you for your comments. From the mouths of babes, much like that kid in Florida, right? And we spoke up against masks too. I mean, the great thing about her comments, in addition to being thoughtful and considerate of others, including her siblings, is you can feel the authenticity. She's describing experiences she's actually living rather than, you know, just reciting propaganda from the teachers' unions, which is what normally you get from the other side, both the adults and their children used as tools of propaganda for the teachers' unions.
And teachers, we see you when you go in behind your office, take off your mask, enjoy some freedoms that you don't allow to your kids. This is child abuse. I mean, Dan, you and I should put on a mask at 6:30 this morning and not take it off until 6 o'clock at night.
Why?
Just to be in simpatico with the kids to see what they go through. And all the teachers should do that, and all the government officials who are demanding mask mandates in schools. Schools is not the hot spot. Schools is not where the problem is. This has got to end.
I don't care if I don't care that school board members or politicians feel the pain of students. I care that you're negatively impacting students' intellectual and social development for no good reason.
Well, there's 20 states with statewide school mask mandates, and there's a few who, if you have been vaccinated, you get to take your masks off. And that's Massachusetts, West Virginia, Michigan, and Pennsylvania.
So again, considering that 10-year-old girl's testimony, and perhaps considering what kind of environment your kid's going to be in at school, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you going to send your kid back to a school where masks are mandatory throughout the day, just as that 10-year-old girl in Naperville 203 described?
I mean, it's so bad that in Minnesota and certain school districts, because they're having a heat wave right now, they canceled class or school for the rest of the year. Everything's remote. In New Jersey, they lifted the mask mandate indoors because of extreme heat situations, which really means they're not useful or necessary in the first place, right? I mean, if it's that imperative for your health because you don't want anybody to teach from the grave, then why, if it's that important, you wouldn't lift the mask mandate because of heat conditions.
Well, right. Again,
just the hypocrisy and bull jive of this whole
If it's life
thing.
And death, it's. I mean, I just go back to her testimony. There's really nothing more that needs to be said. I just want to refer to her testimony. She's as much of an expert on the topic as so many of these TV doctors. Why is it okay when I go home and play on the weekends to not wear a mask, but then how am I not a disease vector, according to you, when I come back to school after having not worn a mask playing on the weekends or going to summer camp? How is it that there isn't bodies strewn across summer camps in Wisconsin based on the approach that you're taking here? I mean, are we just going to be honest? This is posturing by the teachers' union. This is fear-mongering and the fear-addled at the hands of the teachers' union. That's what this is. This is what K-12 education has been for some time. You're just finally getting hip to it because of the profile of the pandemic and the massive policy changes.
Well, I talked to parents. What can we do?
K-12, what K-12 has been. A third-party administrator for salaries and benefits for the adults. That is its primary purpose. It is not in the business of educating your children, and you may have noticed because, generally speaking, it's not doing a very good job of what you think its mission is. That's not its mission. They can state it all they want, and then you look at their actual conduct. And if it's not driven home by their conduct over the last year, then nothing will drive it home to some. I mean, again, there's some surfaces that are impenetrable, and that's between the ears of a lot of these leftist suburbanites, I'm sorry to say.
Well, what could we do?
What do you mean, what
I talked
you
to
do?
Some parents yesterday.
I asked, what are you going to do?
What are we going
to
do?
Are you forced to send your kids to the schools that you're sending them to?
I am, yeah.
How?
Lot of parents. Because, Dan, my kids are 6'5 and 6'6, and I can't physically say, oh, now you're not going to the school that you've gone to for a while, and they're going to be 18,
so they can decide.
No, but well, when they're 18, they can decide.
When they're 18, they're out of high school.
No, mine are still in high school because I started them early. And there's a lot of parents that have this problem. There's a lot of parents like me who enrolled their kids in private school to avoid this nonsense, and the kids just simply refuse to go. So then you have to hire these guys that are bounty hunters to come and get them, and it's just a joke.
Bounty hunters?
Oh, yeah, there's an app for that.
You have to have dog come and take your kids to school? I don't know.
I just don't know what to do. If we have a mask burning, somebody suggests we should go to Springfield and
You can do
burn
all that.
Masks.
You can do all that.
But is that really effective?
But at the end of the day, the school year rolls around and the question is, what are you going to do? The answer is fill in the blank. I don't know. Different people are going to do different things. But, I mean, just understand at minimum what you're subjecting your kids to and the impact that we won't fully understand for some time on their intellectual, mental, and social development. Just as we have some indication at the lost time in classrooms or the remote learning, what that impact has been in terms of retarding the pace of kids' intellectual growth. And we talk about this all the time in the context of CPS. This is pre-pandemic. You know, you get one shot.
Yep.
You get one shot when kids are 9, 10, 11 years old. You don't get to come back 5 years after the fact and say, okay, we're ready to get serious now, when you've got, you know, in the case of CPS, 11th graders reading and doing math at fifth grade level. You don't get to come back. You don't get to come back when they're 30 and say, we kind of messed up in that, 4 to 7 year period, your formative years. We'd like to undo what we did. You don't get to undo it. You get to just pay for what you did for a long time to come. That's what's going to happen. And frankly, the idea that, and I know it's easy for me to say, I don't have kids and so on and so forth, so you can go after that all you want, but also address the substance. The idea that you're compelled to send your children to a school you don't want to send them to, I don't find persuasive, especially in an environment where you've got parents' co-ops and these neighborhood cells and homeschooling resources like we've never had because of the explosion in homeschooling. I just don't find it compelling when people say, I'm forced to send my kid to a school that I don't want to send them to. You're not.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Welcome back. And we're pleased to be joined now by our friend, the president and founder of PermaSeal. You hear information about PermaSeal routinely on the program. He is Roy Spencer. Roy, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into what is current in terms of PermaSeal's work and the particulars that people should know about, just give us a little bit of the backstory on the business.
Well, sure. I started the business myself 42 years ago, and today we've grown to from the world's smallest waterproofing company to one of the largest. We have over 300 employees now, and we service the Chicago metropolitan area. We've helped over 450,000 homeowners keep their basements healthier and drier and more valuable.
And what new services are you offering now as you did, say, 5 years ago?
Well, we've added several new services. We've got a concrete lifting service. It's an offshoot of our structural repair. We actually repair houses that are sunk and raise them and things. But we can also now raise concrete slabs, your sidewalk, your driveways, your front stoop, your patio decks. We can quickly and easily restore that back to level concrete using existing concrete. We're excited about that. It's one of our fastest growing services. We also, of course, have the basement defenders, my own invention, and it actually can test your sump pumps every day and alert you if there's any problem. So it takes the rolling the dice situation out of your sump pump situation. You wonder, even if you've got a backup pump, you wonder and hoping that it's going to work. But now you will know because it's tested every day. So pretty excited about those innovations.
So what's the sort of best practices when it comes to prevention of leaking or foundation cracking and so on and so forth? You mentioned the sump pumps. Are these things that should be sort of checked every spring, summer, and obviously repairs made as needed?
Yeah, there's certain key things that every homeowner should do, and one of them is testing your sump pump regularly. And again, the basement defender can take care of that for you. Kind of, you can cross that off your list. But the other are a couple of things you can do while you're walking around outside, and one is to make sure those downspout extensions are extended away from the house, and also check your window well. There's window wells. If you have basement windows, there should be a drain in there. You want to make sure that's kept clear, because those are things that just takes a couple leaves or a rodent or something to get in there, clog up the drain, and it works out like your kitchen strainer. If that gets clogged, you can have a flood, and you can have a flood in your basement just because a drain gets clogged. So we've got custom well covers and things like that. So those are a couple easy things that homeowners can do regularly, and they should do, because that's not something we can check for them every day, but they can. And we can help them with that, make them permanent maintenance-free with underground extensions for the downspouts and things. So I do want to say that will not only help keep your basement dry, but that also helps avoid structural problems. We do a lot of structural repairs. this weather cycle we're having right now with the real hot and dry, and then we're subject to some frequent rainstorms. Our houses sit on clay, and the clay expands and dries out, and then it expands when it rains. So the foundation is actually moving, and if there's one part of the foundation that's very wet because the downspout wasn't extended, that won't move the same as the other, and you can risk a structural problem there. And so that's just a great practice. People don't realize why they should do it, but trust me, you want to keep those downspouts extended.
And again, just in terms of like best practices, like you say, something that homeowners can be cognizant of, so they see something and then they call a professional like you. Obviously, they don't want to pay for you to be there every day, but they want to pay for you to come when they see problems afoot. And so, like, signs that they should be looking for when we're talking about problems with the foundation.
Yeah, well, when you're outside, look at the brickwork. If you have step cracking in the brickwork, you see it stepping down, that's a definite sign probably of a foundation problem, because the brick is resting on the foundation. The foundation sinks, the brickwork cracks. You'll see caulking, large gaps around your caulking, around your windows. That's another sign. Inside, if you have uneven floors, all of a sudden you have a gap underneath your baseboard or things are rolling across your floor, that's another telltale sign. If you see new cracks in the drywall or plaster or sticky doors or windows, these are all symptoms of a structural problem that people don't necessarily associate with the foundation, and they end up, you know, replacing windows sometimes, having tuck pointing, and doing unnecessary and repairs that won't solve the problem. So the nice thing, Dan, is you mentioned what can homeowners do. They can call us for a free estimate. And our consultants are trained to not only look for, you know, potential and active water leaks, but also structural problems. So that's a free inspection. They can call 800-421-SEAL today. You know, because it's not raining, we've got time, we can get out right away and give them a free inspection and help them avoid some of these problems.
And we're talking to Roy Spencer, president and founder of PermaSeal. Yeah, now's the best time to fix your foundation, because you're offering 10% off any new proposal up to $1,000 or no interest payments for up to 60 months.
Yeah, that's outstanding. It really is a great time, like I say, to get these things. If you've been living with the problem or you're concerned, you have some concerns, it's a great time, and we do have a best price, and it's never been more affordable to get your basement, you know, permanently dry.
And to schedule your free consultation, you call 1-800-421-SEAL, 1-800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net. That's permaseal.net. You hear Amy talking about PermaSeal all the time.
Yes,
during the
I
week.
Do.
And so there you go.
I'm also a customer.
Yes, yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
No, she's not just the.
I'm serious.
She's not just the spokesmodel. You're also a client. There you go. President and founder of PermaSeal, Roy Spencer. Roy, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights and expertise.
Well, thank you both. You have a great day.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and you think it's going to stop. You think if you just look away, it'll go away. Okay. Gender equity. The latest frontier in gender equity comes to us from D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton. Gosh, she's been there a long time. She dates back to that Children's Defense Fund racket with Hillary Clinton. She introduced a bill this week that would require car crash test dummies to use both male and female models.
I mean, what a colossal waste of energy.
Once there was a delegate in D.C. got into an accident and caught at Cobb's school, but when he finally came.
Sing it so our listener can email again.
Hair, yeah. I turned from black into bright white. He said that
you
it
know
was
why we're playing
from when the cousin smashed
the dummies.
Not everybody knows this is the crash test dummies.
All right, well, they know now.
Yeah. Delegate Norton.
It's over.
Ooh. Women have achieved equality on the road when it comes to driving. Yeah.
And don't start. You guys really, are more reckless than we are.
Yeah. And on behalf of the non-male impersonating male drivers on the road, Yeah, we're really ecstatic about that. But when it comes to safety testing to keep them safe on the road, they're nowhere near achieving equality. Crash test standards are antiquated. We must update these standards now, especially as more people return to their daily commute in the next few months. Mm-hmm. Now, this is interesting because Eleanor Holmes Norton's office said,
yeah,
and I did not know this, more important than differences in average height between males and females, there are biological differences in anatomy, such as average neck strength and posture, and how female and male bodies react in a crash. Wait, what are you talking about?
I thought we're all the same.
There are biological differences between men and women?
Your necks are stronger than ours?
And yet in the area of physical strength, structural strength, I'm sorry, that's not what I understand from the trans athletes. This is not an LGBTQ-compliant proposal based on this bigoted, transphobic rationale, is it? Well, good golly gee, the intersectionalists run into one another. You better put some helmets on those intersectionalists, do some safety testing. How about that? And in the business of renaming, mascots, Lakeshore Drive.
Thank goodness that didn't happen. That got tabled. Instead, we're going to waste $40 million on 3 DeSable statues throughout Chicago. Because we really need that.
Right. Not, you know,
because we already have a park.
So we're not renaming statues. We're just raising them. Sure.
But,
you know, all that is passe. The next frontier on the renaming front? Birds. Birds.
What's wrong with birds? Please don't tell me. I can only handle so much bull jive a day.
I'm sort of an amateur ornithologist myself. The Bachman sparrow, Wallace's fruit dove. Yeah, you know where I'm going.
Are you naming desserts or creatures?
Well,
Wallace's fruit dove?
Wallace's fruit dove was the name of my college garage band. We were a Crash Test Dummies
cover
band.
Okay.
See what I did? Brought it all around. The Bachman sparrow, Wallace's fruit dove.
I swear that sounds like a dessert.
Legacy of racism.
Oh, that's a pretty bird, actually.
Oppressors.
The Wallace fruit dove. Why is that?
They bear the names of men who fought for the Southern cause, stole skulls from Indian graves for pseudoscientific studies, later debunked, bought and sold black people.
Pretty bird.
The Audubon Society. That's got to go. John James Audubon was an enslaver who mocked abolitionists working to free the slaves.
I guess they're going to have to rename Audubon Middle School.
That is under consideration. The National Audubon Society is considering renaming
themselves to
116 years old, 500 chapters.
Oh, come on.
The interim chief executive of the Audubon Society. I'm deeply troubled by the racist actions of John James Audubon and recognize how painful that legacy is for black, indigenous, people of color who are part of our staff, volunteers, donors, and members. Although we've begun to address this part of our history, we have a lot more to unpack. Oh, the unpacking. Let the unpacking begin.
And reimagining.
So the healing.
You
want to
reimagine unpacking.
Usher in the healing through the unpacking.
No, but there is Audubon Middle School. I'm sure they're going to rename that soon. Maybe it's already on the list of the 30 elementary and high schools in Chicago that have to be renamed.
Yeah. How about the Townsend's Wobbler? The Townsend Solitaire? John Kirk Townsend? Whose journal details his exploits in traditional Native American burial grounds in the West in the early 1800s. He dug up and collected skulls for studies of Native Americans, studies that sought to prove the inferiority of indigenous people. And you got a warbler flying around with his name on it? Can't have that.
Should we shoot it down if we see it?
Is that the kind of country you want to raise your children in? With a Townsend's Wobbler? Allowed to fly freely around. Not me. Nope. The Crimson Jamin's Firefinch.
Not the finch.
You think that can stand in an enlightened society?
The Townsend Wobbler is cute, by the way. I like the fruit dove best. What am I looking up now? A finch? What's its name?
The Jamison's Firefinch. James Sligo Jameson wrote in his journal about a heinous act that he committed against a young girl he purchased as a quote-unquote joke during an 1888 expedition in Africa. Oh, there was that sort of thing going on in Africa? I thought it was only in unenlightened places like America. Interesting. Anyway, the Jameson's firefinch?
Gone. Shoot it down if you see it. Ask questions later. Just take charge.
Chris and Carrie.
Hey, guys. Real quick. You know, if we want all this equality with these crash test dummies, maybe we should make them 300 pounds. I mean, our nation is skyrocketing in its weight, you know, just to be fair.
There's no question about that. We don't want to be fat phobic when it comes to crash test dummies. We should adjust the median weights for male and female the way the airlines are doing so they don't crash. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Absolutely. Ugh. Nick on the Northwest side.
Yes, great show as usual. You're intelligent there. You do your homework, both of you guys. About 4 years ago, maybe longer, the Germans used to actually use cadavers, people who donated the body to science. One of the little fine print conditions was they might use them in a crash test to see how the body reacts. And then people somehow got sensitive about it and decided to use the plastic or whatever material they use. And I don't know if there are men and women. Who knows, you know, that should be checked into. I think we should have a worldwide investigation. What do you think?
Thanks, Nick. Chuck and Delavan.
Autobahn used to have subscribers, and he, his prints, bound folio, and so the first 10 prints, which was the American Turkey, that he sent that to Benjamin Franklin, but he canceled his subscription. What I was talking about was when you were talking about all these statues that have been turned down, Robert E. Lee statues, and we've always sent a called in and said, did they knock down all those statues, and they're going to make this Gustavo statue? And the next question for the statues is, where are Christopher Columbus statues?
They're in a hidden location.
Thanks, Chuck. They're in Al Capone's vault.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Former President Obama sat down for one of those deep dives he does with,
I guess, CNN, probably, maybe Anderson Cooper.
Yeah, Gloria Vanderbilt's kid. And, you know, we're talking about somebody who has the depth of a cookie tray intellectually. But he has updated his rhetorical explanation of race relations in America. Clinging to guns and religion was 1.0. You know, that's a couple decades old now. You got to update the rap. So here's this new pattern on what's going on here.
It's hard for the majority in this country of white Americans to recognize that, look, you can be proud of this country and its traditions and its history and our forefathers, and yet it is also true that this terrible stuff happened. And that the vestiges of that linger. I also think that there are certain right-wing media venues, for example, that monetize and capitalize on stoking the fear and resentment of a white population that is witnessing a changing America and seeing demographic changes, and do everything they can to give people a sense that their way of life is threatened and that people are trying to take advantage of them. And we're seeing it right now, right, where you would think with all the public policy debates that are taking place right now that, you know, the Republican Party would be engaged in a significant debate about how are we going to deal with the economy and what are we going to do about climate change and what are we going to do about... Lo and behold, the single most important issue to them apparently right now is critical race theory. Who knew that was the threat to our republic? But
yeah.
Those debates are powerful because they get at what story do we tell about ourselves?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
You're clinging to your race and your way of life. Can you believe people are talking about critical race theory? You see what he did there? It's the same thing I explained yesterday that Clarence Page did in the Tribune. What is all this business about critical race theory? This is sort of like an esoteric topic for academicians and, you know, certain disciplines. Critical race theory? All we're talking about is a little equity here. A marginal issue. The American Bar Association presents critical race theory as an analytical tool for interrogating the role of race and racism in society.
Oh, that sounds lovely, but that's not what it is.
The existence of critical race theory that's showing up in school board meetings where people are hashing it out over curriculum.
And books that are being read, books that they're forcing our kids to read. Can I take us to Loudoun County, Virginia, again?
The books that are also informing who gets whistled in by corporate America to do DI sessions, diversity, inclusion, equity sessions for, you know, via these HR minders for their, to check the box for their employees.
You want to hear it?
It's hold on a second. Let's digest what Obama had to say for a second here. So is that what's happening? You see the ham-handed reversal he's trying to do? You're talking about something nobody's talking about. It's not a big deal.
He's just telling us to move along.
And to the extent that there is some effort to advance racial equity, what you're, you know, and you're opposed to that, well, that's just because you're a racist and you don't want to let go of the vestiges of systemic racism, of institutional oppression, and give up your way of life. This is sort of his soft peddling the white privilege critical race theory rap, which is what he does. Nobody's talking about this. Critical race theory, how could you be talking about this? It's not like it's everywhere, when in fact it is everywhere. And it's, the other piece of this is important. Some right-wing outlets, you know the problem in this country, that right-wing media, that dominant right-wing media. It's another one. It's another attempt, ham-handed attempt for a full reversal. So it's conservative news outlets that are stoking racial animus. Not the New York Times sponsored 1619 Project and its Pulitzer Prize winning principle. I'm sorry, where did critical race theory come from? And where is it being imposed? I mean, who is on advance when it comes to critical theory, critical race theory, $90 million worth of corporate money washing around at Black Lives Matter, a self-identified Marxist organization? It's important to pick up on what Obama's doing rhetorically because it will be repeated by all of those overeducated, non-critical thinkers in your social circles. That's exactly what they'll do. The right-wing media is the problem. White people clinging to their privilege is the problem. What's the big deal about trying to provide more opportunity for BIPOCs in America? Well, that's not what this is about. And you're not going to flip the script on me. And certainly a cipher like Obama shouldn't be able to either. I mean, he will with Gloria Vanderbilt's kid. But don't let him get away with it. And don't let the Obama acolytes in your social circles get away with it either.
And the way he laughed, he was so cavalier, like, oh, nobody's talking about critical race theory.
It's dismissive. It's not even a topic. You know what's a topic?
You should worry about climate change.
Right, of course.
And we should worry right now about getting our kids out of masks at school, but okay.
Of course. Remember, it is worth noting, by the way, all of the promise of Obama, mainly manufactured by the D.C. press corps and their regional outlets around the country, when he was elected in 2008. Where were we at the end of his term when he left office in 2013? According to surveys, race relations had worsened under Obama. He was going to heal the nation. He would, you know, obviously the waters would recede and black and white would live in harmony because he was this transformational figure that just through the force of his visage was going to affect racial healing. Yeah. And we left, and 8 years later, things were worse. Why? Because he is a smoother talking race hustler than the overt extortionists like Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson. It's the same race hustle. It's just a more polished version of it. He gets $50 million Netflix contracts instead of extortion payments from corporate America like Jesse and Al get. He's really a despicable person, and he's completely vacuous. The intellect, I mean, this is something that's bugged me since he was a state senator. The idea that he uses proper syntax and he has a certain patois and that is a substitute or a proxy for his intellectual depth is a joke. Because you know what? He's a joke. And so is Michelle. Just go back and read her thesis if you haven't. Read her thesis at Princeton. I have. What a slop. Intellectual slop. These two are a joke. And the fact that they're going to be forever immortalized on the lakefront in Chicago is a perfect, perfect statement about Chicago and Chicago's electorate for the last 100 years and going forward, probably for the next 1,000.
Now I want to know what her thesis was about. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
So the critical race theory that nobody's talking about except right-wingers is being talked about.
Yeah, in Loudoun County. Parents, you know, because they're speaking up. I'm really proud of them. They're not just sitting down and taking it like parents here in Chicago Public Schools are. They brought some books up and read some passages from critical race theory. New books that the kiddies are going to read in the fall.
9th grade mandatory curriculum. Oh, you guys are good. You took it out of family life education where parents could not opt out. You put it in mandatory curriculum where not only 9th grade will get it, and if they missed it, they will get it in 11th and 12th grade. How is that appropriate? Woe to you who are seeking re-election.
To the female board members, do you know what a MILF is? It's slang for a mother I'd like the taken out of context? Probably not. This book contains the word 49 times, the word 31 times, the word 3 times, and the word 10 times.
I wanted to tell you so many times that he's afraid he'll get into trouble. If somebody got the wrong idea, he could be arrested, Lula says. Maybe he should be. Isn't he like in his 40s? His late 40s? Are you serious? I saw him, Rory. This guy's molesting you. Rory says, he's not, Lula. Please, I'm begging you. He's not hurting me.
They were reading passages from the books that people are going to...
Well, that's not critical race theory. Well, they're not referring to critical race theory. You're talking about profanity in books and pedophilia, which I know is also in the curriculum in K-12 education. But, yeah, we'll get to Loudoun County. And, by the way, that PE teacher that just got reinstated. Oh, yeah. Tony in Downers Grove.
Yes, Dan, this piece of garbage... He was the most divisive president, along with his wife, who you listen to her commencement speeches, telling an all-black college that they'll still have to struggle. Students at an all-black college. But this is the same playbook, Dan. We talk about this. This is, you're afraid of change. Why are you afraid of change?
Yeah.
And this guy, mm-hmm. He gets up there, he makes speeches, and you just have to listen. You have to, like, parse the words, and they are so divisive, and people fall for it. And the media globs onto it. Don't pay attention to CRT. Meanwhile, also don't pay attention to the voting law changes. This is just nothing. And this is going to continue because nobody's calling it out.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Bob in Waukegan.
Yeah, preach it, Reverend Proft. This is insanity. You call him a race hustler. I think Tucker Carlson called him a race arsonist, which is what he's become since he left the presidency. Also,
he was
a race arsonist when he was the president. So, yeah. And the practice of progressionism, is that what it is when you throw off what you're doing on the other party? The same thing was in the Wall Street Journal like 2 weeks ago with Carville saying that the Democrats are the party of the police and,
right,
and
right.
law enforcement. I haven't seen a truckload of BS like that since I was on the farm.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Yeah, projection is what they do. You're right about that. Kenny Hsu is the president of Color Us United, a group that advocates for race-blind policies, writing over at Quillette, the difference between the civil rights movement and CRT, critical race theory, isn't one of degree or shade. It's foundational. Proponents of the former, civil rights, believe America can transcend her flaws and sins, while the latter, critical race hustlers, present those flaws and sins as a pretext to destroy its liberal soul, small l. One side pursues equality and progress, while the other side makes a fetish of oppression and division. It's easy to see which path leads to a brighter future for our country. And this is the importance of it, of course. No pushback from Gloria Vanderbilt's kid, but this is why it's important. It's only the future of the country at stake that Obama scoffs at. Of course he does, because he knows that it's the future of the country at stake. And he knows, like Obamacare, like all of these other neo-Marxist policies, they can't sell it straight away. They can't walk it in through the front door. They have to sneak it in the back door. Doug McGregor is a parent, Naperville 203. Let's go back to Naperville 203. It's not just the young kids there that are making sense. Doug McGregor took to the microphone to offer comments on critical race theory since making a fetish of oppression and division is what the school board and this ridiculous superintendent Bridges, who's not a doctor, Bridges that they have in Naperville 203. What a disgrace Naperville residents have allowed to occur with that school district. Here's McGregor. He's got an idea for Bridges. Live your values.
My name is Doug McGregor. I'm a parent and a taxpayer. In April 2019, District 203 began a series of three open forums for diversity and inclusion where we were introduced to Dr. Leakes. We are shown a series of slides by Superintendent Bridges and Assistant Superintendent Patrick Knowlton that showed the achievement gap between Asians, whites, Hispanics, and blacks. Across the nation, state, and here in Naperville, blacks were shown to be far behind. Every academic knows this, and it's been like this for decades. We were told the reason for hiring Dr. Leakes was to close that achievement gap. To be clear, the taxpayers of Naperville were told that hiring a director of diversity and inclusion was for the purpose of closing the achievement gap. We know there are other initiatives coming, but that was the thrust of that first forum. And according to all of you, the way to raise test scores for blacks is to force critical race theory down the throats of teachers, staff, students, and taxpayers. Critical race theory is pure Marxism. It separates human beings by race and teaches that all whites are oppressors and blacks are oppressed. It's blatant racism. Here's Ibram X. Kendi in his own words. The only remedy for past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy for present discrimination is future discrimination. This is the filth the taxpayers of Naperville District 203 are paying Dr. Leakes $128,000 a year for. Critical race theory is against meritocracy, hard work, personal initiative. Critical race theory teaches that everything boils down to race and that whites have only benefited from a system of white supremacy, white privilege, and systemic racism. So to you, Dr. Bridges, if you truly believe in critical race theory and teaching it in our schools, why haven't you resigned? Because your station in life, your position of power and prestige and wealth were not achieved by talent, hard work, talent, and skill. They were all attained by white supremacy, white privilege, and stomping on the backs of marginalized people of color. So set an example. Walk away tonight, not tomorrow, not after breakfast, right now. Leave your position, your $286,000 a year salary, and your pension, and give it to a marginalized person of color. You owe it to the taxpayers of Naperville to set this example. You guys wanted an uncomfortable conversation. You got one.
Yeah, how about it? How about it? Live your values. No, you don't just get to write a check and say, you know, I'm doing my part. Like the people want to increase taxes. Well, I'll pay more taxes, but everybody's got to pay. No, I'll do something. I'll support reparations, but everybody's got to pay. No. You're a leader. You lead the way. And it's not a check. It's your profession. You turn over your professional position to somebody that you've oppressed. You're a representative of these vestiges that Obama spoke about. Unburden yourself from your privilege. Bridges, Naperville 203. Take a walk.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I know this is a Pride Month, year, decade, millennia. Literally in Canada, it's Pride Summer.
It is?
Month is not sufficient. By the way, I heard this on another Chicago radio station yesterday, this advertisement, you know, celebrating Pride Month, and it was LGBTQ people are just more fun. What does that mean? What does that mean?
Shaming us because we're not part of that community?
Well, what does it mean? They're more fun. How? I honestly don't know. It's a neutral question. You said they're more fun as a group. Tell me how.
More colorful, flamboyant. I don't know.
Is they dance better? I don't know. Is that caricaturing them?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And then that's wrong. And it's labeling, and that's wrong too.
I want the people who are making the statement to explain it to me.
Really?
LGBTQ, this was a 101.1. Flipping through, listen to music.
You listen all the time.
LGBTQ people, they're more fun. How? All right. Loudoun County, Virginia. One judge is not completely blinded by the enforced celebration of Pride Month. We brought this story to you the other day. Byron Tanner Cross is a PE teacher at Leesburg Elementary in Loudoun County. A lot of action in Loudoun County, Virginia.
I know. It's kind of crazy. Every day there's news coming out of there.
Here is what he said to the school board before he was suspended.
We condemn school policies like 8040 and 8035 because it will damage children, defile the holy image of God. I love all of my students, but I will never lie to them regardless of the consequences. I'm a teacher, but I serve God first, and I will not affirm that a biological boy can be a girl and vice versa because it's against my religion, it's lying to a child, it's abuse to a child, and it's sinning against our God.
Well, a judge in the case, he filed a suit seeking an injunction to the suspension. The suit will continue, but the judge granted an injunction holding that Mr. Cross's religious liberty and free speech rights are integral to the case and that Cross's criticisms are protected by the First Amendment. It's very similar to the case that you had. We talked to Nicholas Merriweather, who's a professor at Shawnee State University. He's litigating this as well, refusing to call the student by their preferred pronoun and suggesting that it was a matter of conscience as well. And that's being litigated at the federal level. That's a collegiate case. These are going to be important cases in determining whether religious liberty is still a thing, still one of those pesky freedoms protected under the First Amendment. We're going to find out, and we're going to keep you updated. New Trier 203 school board meeting. The meeting was dominated, the most recent one, by a discussion, pro and con, about the book Two Boys Kissing. It is required reading in sophomore English at New Trier High School, Two Boys Kissing. And if you want to strip the excitement out of soft porn literature, in quotation marks, there's no better way to do it than have middle-aged men and women read from it. Take a listen. Here's parent number one. Tracy Kearney.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Tracy Kearney, and I live in Glenview. I'm a community member, a Nutria Township resident, proud parent of two 2021 Nutria grads, and parent of one rising sophomore, senior at Loyola, and in all circumstances, a taxpayer. I am here to talk about the book, Two Boys Kissing, a book that I recently learned that, is required reading for our sophomore English, and the appropriateness of this book. To underscore my concern, let me read a passage from the text. Early in the book, there is a scene where a father finds out his 17-year-old son is soliciting men online, and he confronts his son. Do you just go off and f*** men? Is that it? While we're asleep, you go out and f*** them? No, Cooper finally says. What is this then? What kind of whore are you? F*** whore. These are not words any son should hear from his father. But a father's rage has its own language. It doesn't have to talk like a father. I agree that a son should never hear these words from a father, but they should also not hear them in a Nutria classroom. The assignment for this passage asks students to write about the value of using occasional swear words and whether they enhance the scene or seem gratuitous. Is it appropriate to ask students to comment on what effect profanity has on the scene when your own board policy, 6:80, about controversial topics, adopted just last month, prohibits profanity and slander? What curriculum standard is this book meeting? What was the universe of choice when you were choosing this book? Why this book? Thank you, and I look forward to your answers. Mm-hmm.
Retired AP teacher. Next up.
Good evening. My name is Della Deem from Glenview. I'm the parent of a Nutria grad. I am a retired high school teacher, an AP teacher. I am also here to comment on the book, Two Boys Kissing. To restate, this book seems to be in violation of board policy 6:80, teaching about controversial issues. It contains profanity, sex scenes, and underage drinking. Here is another example. Julian, an adult, and Cooper, a 17-year-old, met using a sex app, and they are meeting in person for the first time. They're drinking Jack and Cokes. Quote, Cooper has seen so many scenes of guys doing this, gotten hard to them doing this, jerked off to them doing this. Now here it is. Julian's got a great body. He leans in, pressing their mouths together, pressing their bodies together. Cooper wants to pull him down to the couch, wants to get him horizontal. He asks, the bedroom? Julian takes him by the hand, and they're in the tiny bedroom, still standing up and kissing. Cooper topples them over into the bed. Their hands are exploring. Cooper, not knowing any better, goes right for the groin, and Julian pulls away. He retreats for a few minutes, kissing with him on top, then rolling them over so they're kissing with him on the bottom. Groins touching now, him feeling what's going on beneath Julian's jeans. Then rolling over again so he can take off his shirt and then take off Julian's shirt. This is going too slow. Cooper wants to tell him they're going to have a first date, so they might as well go all the way. Might as well see what's going on under those jeans. If this were porn, they'd be naked by now. They'd be blowing each other. To summarize, this exposes our kids to underage drinking, online sex apps, erections, blowjobs, and one-night stands.
You going to wait for the movie or you going to read the book?
That's sophomore English at Nutria.
Required,
Two Boys Kissing.
Required reading. The two women you heard from, including a retired teacher, they're modern-day book burners. Are they the old fuddy-duddies? They're just not with the times. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. What do you think?
I think that the MILF thing in Loudoun County is nothing compared to that book, Two Boys Kissing. That's disgusting. Why have them read that? They're just promoting and pushing their agenda that everyone should be gay and please go out and try it. It's okay.
Here's a mom who has a gay daughter who spoke at the meeting against the book.
At some point, what do we say about their innocence? We got to save something. Look at the world they're in right now. You know, and they're, as if they don't know that there are people that are gay in the school or something. I have a gay daughter. I don't want her reading that book. And she's accepted by me. She is accepted by her friends. She doesn't need this porn to be accepted. All I know is I pay taxes, and I don't want to pay taxes for porn. I don't want to. And, you know, and you're talking about the teachers coming in, oh, this is a great book, we should have it because it teaches this or that. They're benefiting from those taxes. I think it should be something the parents decide. Parents should say whether they want porn or not. And I can tell you, because I do have a gay daughter, this book's not going to change anything for her. It's not. I just want to know why we're listening to kids who don't even know the direction of up or down. Think about what you thought, what you said, what you thought was going to happen in life when you were 18. How different is it now? I want tax-paying adults to make decisions on whether or not we teach porn, regardless of the gender they're doing it with, in the school.
Yeah, I went to Nutria High School, and then I went on to Northwestern to major in gender studies with a minor in porn. Or a concentration, maybe, in porn.
I mean, it promotes all the wrong things, as that woman said. Sex apps with one-night stands, drinking.
I love that it's a violation of the board policy passed a month earlier. You know what? But because the policy is just, this is what happens when you're just a sentimental barbarian. You make a policy, you think it feels good at the time. Well, then you find something else that feels good. And since there are no principles at stake, you say, well, this feels good too. Are the two in contradiction with one another? Sure they are, but both feel good, so let's do them both.
Disgusting. Can you opt out? My God.
No, not at present. This was interesting, too. A Chinese immigrant spoke to this, just a little bit of a global perspective. And, you know, with respect to somebody who knows something about education in the Far East, I'd take a listen.
You know, you probably don't see many Asian faces here. You know, I grew up in China. I came all the way here to find a good life for my kids. You know, from learning what you are talking about today just really shocking me. I don't think this is the education for. Around the world, in every country, they're teaching their kids to have a right mind and to be strong, to be intelligent. And what you guys are talking about?
3 minutes.
Pervert. This is not for education. This is not for majority of the family. You can do that to a separate group, but not for everybody.
We're at our limit now. Thank you.
Yeah.
Ma'am.
We're at our limit.
Behave, ma'am.
She's used to being silenced by communists. She's from China, after all. Yeah, now she's in New Trier. She thought it was going to be different. Sorry, Miss Chinese immigrant. Sorry, we're not living up to our promise that you thought you were coming to enjoy in this country. and, of course, the supporters, some of the supporters, at least that I listen to, they think they're Holly Hunter in Field of Dreams.
Oh, yeah.
They're, you know, Beulah, you're not going to ban this book. They're trying to ban Huck Finn and this and that. Great works of American literature. They're Two Boys Kissing is being talked about in the same vein as
it's not
as Catcher
in the category.
Rye.
Yeah, please.
I mean, it's absurd on the merits, but that's how they posture themselves. Nobody's talking about banning anything. They're saying, and as you heard those ladies say, why this book? From all the books that we have to choose from, this is a book that's going to advance what exactly with respect to the kids' education? Because that's the point, isn't it? You have to make selections. Nobody's saying the book shouldn't be allowed to be purchased. It shouldn't be probably in the library or wherever else, obviously in the public arena. But why is it part of the curriculum? Because you have choices to make. Are you suggesting that this belongs in the University of Chicago's Great Books course? Is that what you're suggesting? One of the great modern works of Western Civ? If not, then why is it there? Why choose that book? It's a great question. Of course, you're not going to get an answer from the school board. Joe in Naperville.
You know, I'm glad they banned the Pledge of Allegiance, but what I was going to do, if that was in my school district, if that was in my school district for my kids, I would be bringing charges against child pornography, exposing my child to pornography. Take them to the courts, make them prove that it's not pornography. Hold their feet to the fire. This is ridiculous.
Thanks, Joe.
You're a lawyer. Could they do that? It's pornographic. I mean...
Yeah, are you trafficking in child porn, like illegal? No, I wouldn't say that. Although, mandating the consumption of that to minors, we're talking about sophomores, so we're talking about, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds? You know, it's obviously, and I'm a supporter of this, erring on the side of free thinking and free speaking. But so rather than making this a criminal matter, it's a cultural matter. And obviously a K-12 educational matter. John in Lincolnwood.
Oh, hi. I had to call in because it's a sophomore class. And in my sophomore year, I had to read Shakespeare. And that actually helped me get over my dyslexia because the teacher made me read it over and over and over and over until it was fully explained and I got over it. I'm like, now I love Shakespeare. I'd like to know, and I'd like to ask this teacher, this book, Kissing Boys or whatever, how is that going to stimulate the intellect of the sophomore to make them love reading? What? This is absolutely ludicrous. Thank you.
Shakespeare, that's passé.
Shakespeare, please.
You have Ivy League English departments that don't require Shakespeare
to
graduate
possible?
With a degree in English Lit or Western Lit. I mean, you've got the Classics Department at Princeton. John McWhorter recently wrote about this in The Atlantic. The Classics Department at Princeton decided the idea that the Classics major should know Latin or Greek has been a mistake.
Hey.
So, yeah, I mean, this is all being expunged as part of the historical rewrite of Western civilization. You know why? Because Western civilization, oppression, nothing to offer, nothing produced that's worth saving, passing on. Day one in America tomorrow. Margo in Burr Ridge.
Yeah, the parents need to, you kind of need to put blame on somebody. And the person that they should be looking at is the director of curricula. That's who you go. That's who I ended up fighting with in District 181 Elementary School, because that person is picking these books. And that person supposedly, is reading the books and okaying them for the children and all of that. And, they need to be focusing on something other than their libido. The kids are going to figure out their libido without any help whatsoever from the schools. And parents, the other thing parents should do is they should have their own reading list for their kids. Things like The Great Earth, Man Called Intrepid, 5 Years of Freedom, books that they've read that inspired them, because they're not going to get those kind of books at this juncture in school. And, for summer reading, you got to assign your own summer reading for your kids. Anyway, I've gone toe-to-toe with the director, but now that these parents are banding together, they can really make a difference, not just get the, individual books taken out, but try to make a difference with the curricula.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, that's all I'm saying.
Thanks for the call, Margo. Appreciate it. Well, Peter Tragos, who's the assistant superintendent for curriculum and instruction, he was there at that meeting, and he defended it.
Oh.
And he misrepresented the positions of those women and others who opposed the book as part of the curriculum. He misrepresented their positions. Of course he did. He has to caricature their positions in order to dismiss them rather than address sort of the conversation we're having. He's the assistant superintendent for curriculum and instruction, where you've got Shamil Tillery's the director of curriculum and instruction, because there's layers to New Trier because it's such a wonderful school and school district. Paul Sally's the superintendent. He's a big supporter of I Hate White People Day. Remember the I Hate White People seminar day that got nixed?
Yep.
Because parents rose up, like these parents that were rising up at that board meeting yesterday. You know what's interesting about New Trier, too? You know who their director of communications is?
Who?
You'll probably remember her.
Who?
Nikki Dizon.
Nikki Dizon.
She was an AP reporter. She's a political reporter for AP at the state level here. Actually, I like her, and I think she's a good reporter. She was a good reporter. She's got a tough job as director of communications. It'd be nice if all of these deep thinkers at New Trier would be willing to go toe-to-toe with, frankly, the likes of me, or answer the questions that are posed by the likes of some of those people you heard from who are also intelligent people. A lot of intelligent people who live up on the North Shore, and a lot of unintelligent people pretending to be intelligent. And unfortunately, the latter is who's in charge of that school.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and after getting back from her sojourn to Guatemala, Reparation H, there, Kamala Harris, she's the vice president, she sat down with Lester Holt, and, you know, the funt was back.
Yeah,
America's favorite aunt, fun aunt, the laughter, the infectious personality she has was back.
Yeah, you said that the other day. You said, I want, you know, the laughter back. And Dan, she delivered just for you.
Okay. Do you have any plans to visit the border?
At some point, you know, we are going to the border. We've been to the border. So this whole thing about the border, we've been to the border. We've been to the border.
You haven't been to the border.
I haven't been to Europe.
That's so weird.
I don't understand the point that you're making. I'm not discounting the importance of the border.
Well, I mentioned it because I know Republicans have certainly come at you on this, but Democratic Congressman Cuellar has a border district, has said to you and the president, come. You need to see this.
Listen, I care about what's happening at the border. I'm in Guatemala.
All I wanted to know was that she cared. That was fun. I mean,
she's not going to go to the border, but she's talking about border issues. So she was in Guatemala, then she went to Mexico.
Wait, has she never been to Europe, or she just hasn't been to Europe as vice president?
As vice president, she hasn't been to Europe. Well, you know what? I don't know, actually. But it was very weird. Well, nice pivot, huh? All of a sudden, it's like, then the sky is blue.
Well, wait, Mr. Kamala Harris never took you to Europe?
I'm sure she's been. There's no way. How could you live? I mean.
A lot of people don't go to Europe. They're Miss Elitist. But but Kamala Harris.
She's
Kamala
a senator.
Harris
I'm sure there's
one
someone
of our betters. She's one of our betters.
But wasn't that a weird pivot for a question? Like, because that was the fourth time that Lester had asked her, why aren't you going to the border?
I'll cede my comment on that comment to Andrew Sullivan, because I always like to cede my time to men and women of the left when they agree with me. And Andrew Sullivan's comment was one of the least talented politicians in the country, Kamala Harris. And I thought actually that was generous on his account. Now, the border is not something that Democrat socialists take seriously. So let's get to stuff they do take seriously, spending money we don't have. And this goes to, of course, the Green New Deal, quote unquote, infrastructure divide between Republicans and Democrats. Joe Biden has ended negotiations with Republicans, so on and so forth. And John Tester from Montana, who really he fashions himself sort of as a moderate Democrat, but he's really not, generally speaking. It's sort of shocking that he has staying power in Montana, because his rancher persona is belied by his actual performance. Tester was on with Tapper. Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah. Mr. Tapper.
Talking about that, the infrastructure spend plus the filibuster. Take a listen.
Well, look, I think that the filibuster ends up producing, I think, legislation that stands the test of time. That being said, the filibuster can and has been abused greatly and continues to be abused. Look at the January 6th commission as a prime example. I want to see the filibuster stay in place, but if people are going to use it just to block legislation because they can, then we're going to have to reevaluate it. I'm not there yet, but I will tell you, votes like the January 6th Commission were very disturbing. I was here. I saw what happened. You saw what happened. This is a big deal. We need to get to the bottom of it. And it's not about politics.
No,
it's about
not.
This nation. It's about how we move forward. No, it's about if we're going to let domestic extremism and domestic violence rule the day. And I'm not in that group. I think we need to find out what happened. And we need to make adjustments.
Is there anything more entertaining when a politician tells you it's not about politics? It's an interesting position he has on the filibuster. Apparently, Tapper didn't want to engage on this. So let me just understand. You support the filibuster in principle because it produces legislation that endures the test of time. That's what you said. Except when the filibuster prevents something that you want to happen from happening, then you don't support it anymore. That's a really interesting position of the filibuster. That is essentially the position of Chuck Schumer and blowing up the filibuster. But Tester wants to have it both ways. I know this isn't about politics, though. For more on all of this and more, Selena Zito, Washington Examiner reporter, New York Post columnist, CNN contributor, and author of best-selling Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition Reshaping America, and the reshaping continues. Selena, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with VP Ha-Ha Harris. She had a successful trip to Guatemala. This is going well, her riding point on the border?
Well, you know, obviously we're not privy to any internal conversations that they've had. However, if we're talking about what she is portraying, what she is transmitting to the American public through the public events, you know, I don't think she's done the best job that she possibly can. She's the interview with Holt was uncomfortable mm-hmm. and awkward, and she came across as an unserious person on a very serious subject matter. You know, you have to understand how the American people look at what's going on at the border. You don't need to look any further than states like Texas, where border communities, which are majority Hispanic population, not only flipped during the presidential election and voted for then President Donald Trump, but they've also done it in local elections. There was just a mayoral race a couple of days ago where a city that has long had a succession of Democratic mayors, Hispanic mayors, voted for a non-Hispanic Republican.
Right.
And so these issues they are ignoring at the most granular level do rise up and impact larger elections.
But did you expect more from Kamala Harris? And has she been set up to fail here?
Well, you know, there's certainly been that argument. I don't know that, but I do know that she has not always been her own best advocate for whatever she's trying to promote, whether it was the Kavanaugh hearings or the debate in 2020 and or so far her outward performance as vice president. You can go back and take a look at how she responded during the address in front of the Navy midshipmen, and she turned it into an event about solar panels and gender. And this, you know, here in that interview with Holt, I still don't understand about the "I've never been to Europe" line.
Yeah, it's a head scratcher.
I don't know.
Oof.
Bizarre. Like, be serious in this moment. Don't be flippant because it's a serious event that's happening in the country.
Going over to what Senator Tester had to say and where things stand with the strategy that Senate Democrats are going to employ with an adverse ruling from the Senate parliamentarian on reconciliation. And now it sounds, you know, Manchin is the focus, but it's a lot more senators than just Manchin that are queasy about blowing up the filibuster.
Yeah, I mean, look, Manchin's the fall guy. I have a story coming out today with a lengthy interview with him over a series of several different events over the past 6 weeks. And I, you know, if people want to check it out, it's a really interesting story. They can go to SelenaZito.com. But, you know, Manchin isn't the only one that doesn't want to blow up the filibuster. He's the fall guy. Because he doesn't mind being the fall guy, because he's the guy with the most visible state—a state that is very moderate in nature, whether the voters are Republican or Democrat—and he has stayed true to where he's from. You know, there's a lot of people out there who boast either with a hashtag or a super PAC or, you know, whatever, that say, you know, country before party, but that's just a slogan for them. For Manchin, he does live those words, and he does put his state and he does put the country and the traditions of the Senate ahead of what his political party demands of him. And whether you like his politics or not, or you like him or not, you have to admire that fortitude in the face of all the backlash that he gets.
Since you're out there in Steel Curtain Land and you stay out of the out of the Beltway and out in, you know, small and mid-sized town America, what's your sense of whether or not the ground is shifting under Democrats as it pertains to two issues that could really hurt them, I think, in the midterms? Violent crime in big cities and critical race theory in the schools.
Well, I think here's the thing most people didn't pay attention to. The ground had already shifted against them in last year's election. So all of those Black Lives Matter protests and signs in people's yards and signs that hate has no home here, and the pressure that people felt from corporations, our cultural curators, whether they were sports entities or corporations or the news media, the American people didn't buckle. And if you look down ballot, Republicans had a surprisingly great night in November of 2020. They didn't. They gained 14 seats in the House. They were supposed to lose 20. They gained seats in state legislative bodies across the country. They were supposed to lose majorities. And while they lost Georgia, and that was a very specific an interesting dynamic and a story for another day, they were supposed to lose 7 U.S. Senate seats, and they did not. So the ground was already pushing back against these cultural issues, and I think it's even shifting more since last November.
Well, that's it. You know, the interesting thing is that's not the takeaway that the Democrats have, clearly, because they've doubled down since the November election. And so the question would be, if you're going to double down, then so is the electorate, and it's likely in the midterm to be an electorate that's less favorable to you to begin with. So there could be a real paradigm shift in both chambers come November of 22.
Absolutely. So I say this all the time. Voters keep sending a message to Washington with their vote, and Washington keeps misreading it. Democrats are doing that right now. They think, oh my gosh, you love us. You want us to do everything we want to do. No, that's not what voters told you. Voters told you that they were unhappy with the direction of the country. They were not telling you that you get to be a kid in a candy store and throw out, like you're in a parade in a small town, all the candy to the people, and they're going to love you. That's not what 2020 was about.
You recently wrote a column on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, and it was interesting, President Trump's comment the other day. I think he was talking to Stuart Varney, where he was asked about DeSantis as a running mate, and he said, oh, sure, you know, I consider Ron DeSantis as a running mate if I run. You know, a way to sort of keep DeSantis in the second slot where a lot of discussion, of course, is DeSantis as the nominee in 24 right now. A long time to go. But What's your sense of the dynamic between Trump and DeSantis as they sort of both position for 24, and with DeSantis having to obviously get reelected in 22 first?
Right. I don't think that there's a tension there, because if Trump ran, DeSantis wouldn't run. However, I am one of those few people in the world that doesn't think Donald Trump's going to run in 2024. I really don't. I think he understands that he made history. He was able to accomplish a lot. He changed the political party. And dear God in heaven, why would you want that job?
Well, they're just going to be more impeachment after impeachment.
Yeah.
He'll be the most impeached person walking on this planet.
He is at present.
He is. Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know. But yeah, a lot of Trump supporters, they want him in, and they would like DeSantis as his running mate.
Maybe. I think you need to double down and listen to voters. There's a lot of people who really absolutely love Donald Trump, absolutely think he's the best president that they've had in their lifetime. However, they're not, if you listen to them, they're not completely wedded to him running again. And a lot of people think maybe it's time to pass the torch.
Right.
And it's not a slight to the former president. It's an acknowledgement that it's time to hand over to the next generation. And you created that next generation, since forever and ever you will be, meaning Trump, you will be associated with that success.
She is Selena Zito, Washington Examiner reporter, New York Post columnist, CNN contributor, and author of The Great Revolt, still more relevant with each passing day, The Great Revolt, Inside the Populist Coalition, Reshaping American Politics. Selena, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So I understand that your eldest son, Peyton, has got a new ride.
Yeah. 2013 Lexus.
Wow.
With 50,000 miles on it. And I'm driving around in the hobo ride.
Yeah.
The used minivan that rattles.
He's got obviously a much superior car that's also about 30 years newer than that jalopy that you're roaming the streets in.
Mine's from 2007. And I'm about to hit 200,000 miles. I can't wait. I'm going to take a picture of it.
So does that mean because he's one of the 16 to 19-year-olds who have answered the call to work, 33%. 16 and 19 year olds in the workforce, the highest rate since 2008, but still a far cry from the 50% levels in the 70s. I mean, this is a great environment for teenagers to get jobs. So
he's got to get a job to pay for gas.
He's got to get a job. He doesn't have one.
He starts this weekend.
Oh, okay.
And then my youngest one has already been working at Zia's on Grace and Ashland. Everybody should go visit.
And tip.
Yeah. And tip heavily, especially the bus boys. And the waiter.
And where's Peyton going to work?
He's going to work at Zia's, too. They're both going to work at Zia's.
Nice. The waiters at Zia's rolling up in a Lexus. That should be good for tipping. Wait a second. How much is that waiter making?
It was a gift from his grandparents. It's their hand-me-down vehicle.
Oh.
But they didn't drive it, so there's lots of,
very nice.
Unused miles. I know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that job market to help us do that. Pleased to be joined by Steve Moore for our Wednesday conversation. Economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, guys. By the way, I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so. 9.3 million unfilled jobs in America, an all-time record. We've never seen anything like this before. And I predicted this would happen on this show 3 or 4 months ago with Casey Mulligan, my colleague at the University of Chicago, who is one of the best labor economists. I mean, look, if you pay people to stay unemployed, guess what? You're going to get more people unemployed. But we didn't even expect 9.3 million.
Yeah, but here's some of the good news. One is that's driving up wages that businesses have to offer in order to attract and retain talented employees.
Yeah, and you know, this is the argument that liberals have made. And this was, by the way, do you guys remember something called universal basic income? Remember that? I think it was Andrew Yang who first talked about that idea.
Well, actually, Charles Murray talked about it about 30 years before Andrew Yang did, but okay, go ahead.
Well, how do you like it now? Because this is essentially what the government has set up with all of these unemployment benefits. And by the way, don't forget, you also get free health care, you know, under Obamacare subsidies. You get expanded food stamps. We got rid of all of the work requirements that used to go along with these programs. You get the $3,000 per child payments that are starting to come out. And all this free money, right? People are just getting loaded up with this free money. And then the politicians want to go, gee, why aren't people going back to work? Now, you're right, Jim. My liberal friends said, well, these businesses are just going to have to pay people more if they want to get them back on. If they want to compete with their Uncle Sam, you're going to have to pay more. That's fine if you're Target or if you're Amazon or if you're, you know, Walmarts or Walgreens. Yeah, they've got, you know, the cost structure. They can absorb those higher costs. What this kills is the small restaurants, the small businesses, the little construction firms. Those are the ones who are, you know, think about this. They've been flat on their back for almost a year because of these incredibly stupid lockdowns. Now they're finally getting back on their feet. And the government says, oh, you're going to have to pay your workers $18, $19, $20, $22 an hour. We have a sign outside of a restaurant outside of my little village out in Maryland. And, you know, one of the most popular restaurants says, you know, we can't get our workers back. And by the way, you know, we're offering a free gym membership, you know, free free meals, yeah, free this, free that, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is happening all over the country. And these idiots in Washington are just scratching their heads, saying, why is this happening? And by the way, why is it that your governor there has not suspended the $300 a week unemployment benefits?
Because he cares about people.
Yeah, and you don't.
Yeah, sure he does. What about the small business? But look, this is serious business because, you know, restaurants, for example, operate on really thin profit margins. So if they have to keep paying more and more money to their workers, they're going to put them out of business. And maybe that's
But you have to remember that those people didn't build that. So if they didn't build the businesses, then if the government takes them away, you know, it's just all fair play.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just becoming a bit of a crisis. And last month when these numbers came out, you know, Joe Biden said, oh, well, people are afraid to go back to work because of COVID. And I'm like, wait a minute. Oh, you know, first of all, you know, are people more afraid of COVID today than they were 3 months ago? Come on. I mean, you know, the vaccine is out there. Everything's back to normal. It is a joke.
All right, Stephen Moore.
Making up these excuses.
I've got to ask you about the child tax credit because there's a payment plan, I guess, every July 15th, August.
That's
they released that. So how do you qualify? They said 36 million taxpayers are going to be eligible for the child tax credits. What is it? Is it based solely on income, income or what?
You know, I don't know the exact qualifications.
Yeah,
I know I'm not
getting
income. The money.
Yeah, it's income based, like the stimulus checks.
I'm not rich, but I've got none of this money. You know, all this we keep giving out all of this money, and my wife and I are like, what? We pay a lot of taxes. We're not getting any of this money. And so, look, all of this, folks, is a scheme by Democrats to redistribute income. They really believe the biggest problem in the country is income inequality, and therefore, what we do is just give people more and more money. I mean, God, this is good. First of all, the worst thing you can do for people who've been unemployed for 6 months, 9 months, 12, in some cases 15 months, is we got to get people in the workforce. Every study shows that it has negative health consequences, negative economic consequences for the families themselves. In other words, what I'm saying, we're not even doing the workers a favor by keeping them unemployed. Their work skills start to atrophy the longer that they're sitting on the couch. It's bad for America. It's bad for businesses. And it's bad for workers. Stop. These payments.
Well, Joe Biden has a plan as part of his Build Back Better plan to reduce those 9.3 million job openings. According to the Tax Foundation, his $1.7 trillion Green New Deal / infrastructure in quotation marks plan would result in 101,000 fewer jobs in the country. So that's a start to spend $1.7 million to reduce 100,000 jobs currently available. So we need to spend more to reduce the number of unfilled jobs.
Well, you know, what's so frustrating is, you know, Biden's running around doing these victory laps about, you know, how many jobs we have. And look, it's a great thing. The great news is, you know, the pandemic is over. We got our businesses opening up again. you know, if things are getting back to normal, it's great. It's wonderful. I mean, my God, if Trump were president today, the economy would be absolutely soaring. And yet we're creating all these impediments to getting, you know, our economy functioning again. And, you know, look, it's one thing to have given people all these benefits back a year ago when, you know, when everything was closed down. Everything's opened up again. You know, so we should be getting rid of all of these extra benefits, getting back to normal, getting people back in the workforce. And you're right. All these things are just that the Biden is doing. You know, I hope you like the 9 million unfilled jobs now, because you're right. You know, I guarantee you 6 months or a year from now, we're going to get rid of those unfilled jobs by destroying those unfilled jobs.
Correct. I wanted you to comment on this, too. I'm interested now if this does come to pass and maybe finding a nice Caribbean nation to relocate to, like Grenada, and make it a tax haven, because the G7 agreed in principle to back a minimum global corporate tax of at least 15%. So if you're in the developing world, that's great news.
You know, this is so infuriating, folks. This is infuriating. First of all, the companies that would be most negatively affected, you know what companies these are going after? They're going after Amazon. They're going after Facebook. They're going after Apple. They're going after our major technology companies. Now, look, I'm not happy with our technology companies, but Europeans have wanted to tax our American companies for years and years and years and years. And the United States government should be protecting American companies. Instead, I mean, the Europeans cannot believe their good fortune. We have a dingbat American president who says, hey, yes, we're going to allow you to impose all these new taxes on American technology companies. So this is actually hurting us. And you know, we should be the lowest tax country in the world. We should be the haven for all of this capital coming to the United States. We don't want to reduce tax competition. We want to increase tax competition, because we are the country that this capital should flow to. And by the way, that worked under Trump. We reduced the repatriation tax of capital coming back to the U.S., and we sucked in $1 trillion of capital from the rest of the world. That created jobs. That created a higher stock market. It benefited everybody. And now we've got I never thought I would see the day where we have an American Treasury Secretary running around the world saying, everybody should raise taxes. Let's all hold hands and raise taxes. I mean, that's crazy. It's anti-American.
I never thought I'd see the day. That's a recurring phrase. Hey, Steve, we're playing this game this morning. I want to get you to weigh in.
Oh, yeah.
After a villager in France bitch-slapped Emmanuel Macron, we're asking our listeners which politician they would most like to bitch-slap. And, of course, I know you're a pacifist. But, you know, just in theory, in theory, not that anybody would actually do
anything. I think you're promoting violence.
Yeah, right.
I was going to say, this sounds like an insurrection.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's going to be a commission to investigate me. Yes.
Yeah. So what is the question?
Which politician?
He's not going to answer.
Which politician would Steve Moore most like to bitch slap?
Ooh, I don't know. I think that sounds like a loaded question.
Yeah, you know what? In this day and age,
crybaby,
don't walk him to the cliff and then push him over.
All right, I'm going to have to say,
see, there we go.
I'm going to put it like the worst politician in America today is Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah. Oh, you know what?
That's a good one.
And he might deserve it.
That's a good one.
The way he's treated women and killed elderly people.
Maybe
people
if he would have been,
homes.
Yeah, maybe if he would have been bitch slapped by some women earlier on in life, we wouldn't have the Andrew Cuomo today, Mr. Nipple Rings. All right, yeah. Steve Moore, thank you for that. We appreciate you playing
that's
our little game.
Answer.
Steve Moore, economist, journal columnist, Trumponomics author. See ya.
Okay, see you guys. Have a great week. Take care.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Good piece by our friend Gerard Baker over at the Wall Street Journal about elite groupthink when it came to, well, the latest iteration, when it came to the potential that the virus, COVID, leaked from the virology lab in Wuhan. Baker writes, reminds us, I should say, letters in the Lancet and Nature in the early days of the pandemic from an impressive constellation of experts dismissed the lab leak idea. In fact, in Nature, it was denounced as a conspiracy theory, like it was by politicians. He goes on to say, in each field, science, government, media, tech, there were surely independent-minded people who did seek the truth, but they were no match for the groupthink and the cover-up. And this comparison contrasts as we're focused on our moral indignation in the direction of the Chinese communists. He writes, it seems increasingly likely that Chinese officials mishandled research and misrepresented and misinformed the public, but they did so under pain of punishment, even death, in a system designed to suppress that kind of information. In this country, constitutionally protected free and independent scientists, bureaucrats, journalists, and others did the same. What's their excuse? Ooh, that stings. For more on this, as well as where we stand, pleased to be joined again by Dr. Marty Makary, who's a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's the chief medical advisor to SesameCare and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It, which is now available in paperback as of this week. So pick that up. Dr. Makary, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, great to be with you guys.
What about that comment? You know, we're pounding Chinese scientists and the Chinese communist overlords there. You understand what the scientists are under in China. What about our scientists?
Well, first of all, that article by Jerry Baker, the editor of the Wall Street Journal, was probably the best article I've read in years. And I thought it was particularly interesting and amusing how he said the medical community beclowned themselves by declaring certain protests okay and others unacceptable, depending on what the political cause was.
Right.
And he's right. The groupthink has moved into healthcare and medicine. And it's, as a scientist, look, I've been at Johns Hopkins 20 years doing public health research. I've published hundreds of scientific articles, been dealing with the medical journals for years, and there's too much groupthink, and the cancel culture now has given them this iron fist to start completely eliminating other opinions. And it's scary. And the good news is enough folks who have been suppressed and canceled now are basically banding together and saying, we got to demand more equity and fairness.
So you think that boomerang is happening, that or rebalancing, if you will, is happening, as opposed to just more people being afraid and those, I call them sentimental barbarians, call them what you like, those sentimental barbarians continuing to, run the field.
Yeah, just look at transgender surgery. You can't say a single freaking word about it unless you'll get your career entirely destroyed if you do. Now, enough people now, if you saw the 60 Minutes 2 weeks ago,
sure
are saying, hey, wait a minute. Look at these kids here getting talked into it. Then they have huge regrets. And the process was really shoddy. 2 20-minute visits with a psychiatrist, and you get slapped with a diagnosis of gender dysphoria. And then, boom, you're in the operating room having this mutilating surgery and somebody who shouldn't. Now, there are candidates and there are transgender people who have been underappreciated. But you can't talk about this issue. Okay, you cannot talk about it. And there's enough of this nonsense going on now where we're saying enough of the cancel culture in science.
Well, do they allow gender reassignment surgery at Johns Hopkins?
No, we don't do it. Now, there are kids who are truly transgender biologically and genetically.
Yes.
And so in those cases, there is, and that's been standard of care for decades. That is done and has been done. But the idea that somebody's angry or unhappy and therefore tries a different gender, or you got schools in California where a quarter of the 9-year-olds in the school say they don't identify with any one gender.
Oh,
we've got to speak up.
Please.
We can't be silent on this issue.
Getting back to COVID, although I appreciate those comments, you had a piece recently in the Wall Street Journal, too, another editorial, excellent editorial. And I love the fact that you dug this kernel up from Dr. Fauci. Last August, August 13th, to be precise, as you write, when cases are fewer than 10 per 100,000, quote, you should be able to open up safely and clearly. Well, as you point out, we achieved that milestone mid-May, so why the lethargy in states like, I don't know, Illinois?
Yeah, look, Dr. Fauci totally contradicted himself. I won't pick on him. You know, he's had a bad week.
Yes.
He brought it on himself.
And look, I've disagreed with Dr. Fauci and told him this almost on every single thing of the pandemic. He was a little helpful in the middle of the pandemic in encouraging people to wear masks. But otherwise, it's been very frustrating. Now, look, I respect him. I think he does have good intentions. But the reality is that we can't keep moving the goalposts, and that's what we've done. The perception of risk right now in America is totally distorted. I mean, I went for ice cream with some friends, Dan and Amy, two nights ago, and said, can I try the strawberry ice cream? And they said, no, we're not doing samples because of COVID. And I'm thinking, I can go without the ice cream, but if this is the mentality that's keeping our schools shut and businesses impaired and our airports look like ghost towns right now, then it's sad for the American worker.
Well, look, you just mentioned masks, and I just want to know your personal opinion. And as a doctor, do you think masks work?
I do think masks work, but it's the quality of the mask. So if you're wearing a loose cloth mask, I think it's not going to help much. And it's more the ventilation than it is the mask. I've been wearing masks as a surgeon. I do mostly public health research, but I'm trained as a surgeon and still do surgery. I don't think my patients want me doing surgery without a mask. I am a believer in masks. As you know, I wrote the first piece calling for universal masking in the pandemic in the New York Times in the spring of last year. Took a lot of heat for it. I just thought it was an easy thing for us to flip on and still have a open economy. And that was the path to living a semi-normal life during the pandemic without the lockdowns.
Yeah.
At this point, though, we got to take them off. We got to take
them
off.
Yeah, the pandemic's over.
Well, here's the thing. And by the way, the pandemic was over in exactly the time frame you predicted previously in the Wall Street Journal it would be over. It's worth noting that in terms of comparing and contrast people who know what they're talking about versus Tony Fauci. But with respect to the mask thing, so here's the thing, and I appreciate that you're staying in your lane and you're thinking about this from sort of a medical perspective. But the problem is, you know, it's inherently political because politicians are making public health decisions. And once you give them that mask power and you think, well, this is a way for us to keep open, it's a misunderstanding. I'm sorry, but they're going to take that and they're also going to lock down, which is exactly what they did, because this is always about sort of micromanaging people that they consider liabilities to be managed rather than assets to be allowed to flourish. And so while I appreciate like what you were saying early on about universal masking as the way to maintain more openness, light touch, like some states pursued, Florida, South Dakota, it was never going to be that way in most of the states because of the attitude of the politicians in those states.
Why do people want this pandemic to keep going? I mean, we've met all the criteria, and they keep moving the goalposts and wear masks even though they're vaccinated, as if there's like almost like a pseudo pandemic going on right now. It's a very low level of infection. Daily cases today. Let's take a look, Dan and Amy, today. Yeah, daily cases. Okay, we're below 14,000. I bet you on Monday we'll be below 10,000 cases. Remember, we had over 250,000 a day. In just 4 months ago, and the number of cases today, daily cases today, compared to daily flu cases in the middle of a mild flu season, we've got about 14,000. Middle of a mild flu season, 400,000. We're about 1/50th the number of daily virus cases today with COVID as we are of a flu.
Don't you think Dr. Fauci is the one that wants to keep this going? I mean, now this morning we're learning about this Delta variant. That's the one that ravaged India, and that they claim that kids 12 to 20 are getting that at a rapid rate. But yet I called Lurie's Children's Hospital and their hospitalization is exactly what it was 1 week ago.
And Lurie's would know. They're an incredible children's hospital, and they're seeing people from around the world too, I'm sure. Look, in the UK, there were about 130 hospitalizations with this variant from India. We call it Delta. And we think three may have been in people that received some vaccine, maybe one dose, no one knows. Let's stop with the variant fear-mongering. We've had hundreds of variants. Zero of them have evaded the life-protecting power of vaccinations. or natural immunity, as I just talked about in today's Wall Street Journal piece.
Wait, but before we get to that, you mentioned something about this flu. What is the flu? Who gets
influenza A and B?
I didn't know the flu was still a thing. I hadn't heard anything about it recently. That's still a thing. The flu? People get the flu still? Okay, natural immunity. Your piece there. Washington State has given away a dope for people to take the vaccine. In order to get to the Biden threshold, should we be a little bit more aggressive with our prizes, more addicting prizes like meth or heroin in order to get people to get vaccinated, get to that 70%
level? We've
got
booze. Now we've got a joint for a jab. So what else?
Prostitution. I know they're moving to legalize in Oregon. Yeah. So prostitution. What do we need to, what vices do we need to feed, doctor, in order to get to 70%?
Well, look, United Airlines is offering some miles. To me, that makes sense. Okay, that's fine. But California is going to spend $116 million to give free money to people to take the vaccine, even though 80 to 85% of adults in the United States have immunity now, if you count natural immunity plus vaccinated immunity. The world is laughing at us. Okay, the world is laughing at us right now. We have this massive vaccine surplus, while people and our own neighbors in Brazil are dying of COVID, high-risk, vulnerable people. And we've got this surplus, and we're trying to give two doses to every healthy kid in America and pay people. The world is laughing at us.
Well, there's an Oxford University professor wrote a piece of basically we're selfish Americans, and we're vaccinating kids who aren't super spreaders, who aren't giving it to the grandparents as once thought. And they're not dying from it. More kids die in a school bus accidents than they'd have from COVID. So why don't we give them away? Why is this push? You know, we'll only get unmasked for our kids in school if they're vaccinated.
Well, I'll have a piece tomorrow in MedPage Today. I'll post it on social on that exact issue. A lot of doctors are angry right now. I mean, we're using the precious global vaccine supply to give two doses to healthy kids where, look, I'm not even sure healthy kids need the vaccine. If a kid has a comorbidity, that case is there. If they're healthy, the case is barely there, but it's not compelling. And who said you have to do two? I mean, who says you have to do two? It's a free country. There was an old dictum in medicine that said if you give a blood transfusion, you have to give two units of blood. Well, guess what? We realized after 20 years you don't. You can give somebody one. And so if I had a kid who it made sense to get vaccinated, I would do one dose. By the way, we learned about those heart complications, 7 cases of kids who got heart complications, hospitalized. They all survived it, but they were in the hospital within 4 days of getting the second dose of their mRNA vaccine. That tells you that maybe we're doing too much, too many doses.
Speaking of the vaccines, do you think there is an underreporting of adverse outcomes from the vaccines?
There's an underreporting of adverse events of every single thing in medicine, every medication, every device. And that's because we have this shoddy system of voluntarily allowing folks to self-report. Did anyone, presumably you got your vaccines, did anyone call you a month later and just say, just want to follow up and see if you had any complications? No, we don't do post-vaccine or any surveillance of anything FDA approved. And I would not even blame the FDA for it. I would say this is a system that the pharmaceutical and device industry has ensured stays in place. Because if you're big pharma or the device industry, do you want to create a robust surveillance system to look for complications after the FDA approves something? No, you want it to be out there in the market.
With respect, just going back to the natural immunity and what you talked about in your piece, one of the reasons why we're doing this, we're still stockpiling vaccines, not sharing with people who are in greater need, vulnerable populations around the world, is because you have politicians and TV doctors having fun with numbers. And so they're not, you mentioned 80 to 85%. No. They're more in the 50 to 60% range because it's only vaccinations. There's no consideration of natural immunity.
You know, I can create two totally different scenarios for you by presenting two totally different statistics. I could tell you that 85% of the adult population is immune, and kids are really inefficient transmitters. And we know from Israel, when you have a lot of adults immunized, the kids, the infection rates of kids go way down. That's a positive message. That's what I believe to be true, and that's what I'm saying. That's what's in the Wall Street Journal today. What I wrote is that about 85% of adults in the U.S. have immunity. Now, I could be Dr. Fauci and Dr. Walensky and play fear-mongering and try to manipulate and coax people into a vaccine by saying only 41% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated. And we have to get to 85. Well, you can't. I mean, it's impossible. How are you going to get there? The situation now is dire if you present that statistic. And you need mandates and coaxing kids and demonizing those who are hesitant and blowing off people with natural immunity and say, well, just get it anyway, even though we don't know the data. We do have the data, by the way, and I outline that data in today's piece.
That is a very good Dr. Fauci impersonation you do. I'm impressed. Dr. Marty Makary, professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to Sesame Care, author of the award-winning The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It, which is available in paperback this week. So pick that up and check out his piece in the journal, which I tweeted out as well. Dr. Makary, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, great to be with you as always. Yes. Thanks so much.
Love having you on. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It's rare when a corporate CEO is willing to stare down the woke elements of corporate America. But Liberty Energy CEO Chris Wright did, responding to North Face, the clothier, that refused to make any sort of white label clothes for Liberty Energy because, you know, it's an oil and gas company. Bad. So refused to put their emblem on any of North Face's products. And this is what... How the CEO responded. This is great.
I'm Chris Wright, CEO of Liberty Energy. North Face recently came out against my industry, even refusing to let one of my competitors put their company logo on a North Face jacket. I went through North Face's website of wide-ranging products, and I failed to find a single product that wasn't made out of oil and gas. The great majority of North Face's products, jackets, backpacks, outdoor pants, shirts, shoes, hats, etc., are dominantly made out of the oil and gas that we so proudly produce. Globally, 60% of all clothing fibers are made out of oil and gas. For North Face, it is likely 90% or more. So North Face is not only an extraordinary customer of the oil and gas industry, they are also a partner with the oil and gas industry. So thank you, North Face. And you're welcome.
Yeah, exactly. And I mistake. I thought it was Liberty Energy, but it was actually a competitor. And he took to that competitor's defense and defense of the industry, generally speaking. And it's so great because people are so ignorant. Products made from petroleum. Mark Perry, our friend who's the econ professor over at University of Michigan, he does a routine a sort of annualized update on this and just goes through, you know, the hundreds of products that are made from petroleum, everything from solvents to football cleats to dishwasher parts to faucet washers to food preservatives to drinking cups to hair curlers to folding doors, roller skates, paint rollers, luggage, toothbrushes, and on and on and on. And so, you know, it's purposeful misinformation or willful ignorance. They get to choose companies like North Face and these others that are preening before the public the same way that so many of these politicians do. So it's just a nice moment. You want to recognize people that stand up and are willing to go toe-to-toe on the merits, like Chris Wright over at Liberty Energy. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Paul Kanger, professor of poli-sci at Grove City College and Grove City, PA, contributor to the American Spectator and author of The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, sure thing, Dan. You certainly can't make that stuff out of windmills, can you?
No, you can't.
No, or solar panels.
It's nice because, you know, on the one hand, you have $90 million being funneled from Fortune 500 companies to a Marxist organization called Black Lives Matter last year. And on the other hand, you have these great American companies and entrepreneurs like Chris Wright and his Liberty Energy team that are willing to not only compete in the marketplace successfully, but also stand and deliver against those who would aid and abet the transformation of this country into something less free.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, just last week, so I took a drive through Southern Maryland and West Virginia. I guess it was Northern Maryland, Southern West Virginia. I was going from Antietam, the Antietam battlefield, and there was a new housing development, kind of a new gated community. And there was this giant field of solar panels across the street. And I thought, first of all, this massive field, this is not going to be enough to provide energy for all those homes. It's just not. And second of all, they took up an enormous green area with these ugly, ugly, you know, I don't know, must have been 100,000 square feet of solar panels. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, you fools, you could have gotten this energy from stuff under the ground, from West Virginia coal mines, with this brand new energy, you know, clean burning coal. You could have got this from oil, from fracking in western Pennsylvania and western West Virginia. It's all there. And people have no idea. So yeah, what that CEO said there about North Face, I mean, that is, people are really ignorant. And to bring it back, what you're talking about, groups like Black Lives Matter and others, people just, I can't believe, you know, Dan, Amy, the willingness of people to take a sign and stick it in their front yard because they like the name of an organization or they like a slogan without even realizing, you know, what the founders of that organization are all about. And BLM is a great case in point.
Yeah, well, what is their mission? Because they've changed it a few times. Because you're right, people put BLM in signs in front of their houses, schools, churches.
How have they changed their mission? They've started out as Marxists and they're still Marxists.
Well, it's a great question. And so to be fair, it was founded by three women and mainly by a woman named Patrice Cullors, who, by the way, resigned 2 weeks ago under enormous pressure from people within the organization at her recently buying four new homes over the last 4 years, her finances. And I can tell you, Dan and Amy, I've tried to figure out how much money she's making. And I don't know. And people within BLM don't know. And they're quite unhappy about it.
Why? She's just redistributing resources like a good Marxist.
Yeah, to herself. And actually what she's done here, a number of different people emailed me and said, can you believe this, right? This head of this, that she calls herself a Marxist and she's bought four homes and she could be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars and no one knows how much she's making. I said, well, that's actually typical of almost every Marxist leader of any organization, any regime, any country.
Any university?
Yeah, any university. Fidel Castro, when he died, had long been for years, 10, 20 years, on the Forbes list of the 10 wealthiest leaders in the world. The man died worth billions of dollars. Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania. Look at the Kims. In North Korea, they live like kings
How about Putin at the top of the list?
Putin and every Soviet leader had a dacha on the Black Sea, right? I mean, you could go on and on. In fact, close to home for you guys in Chicago, Gus Hall, who was
communist.
From that area, communist, yeah, Communist Party USA was founded in Chicago in September 1919. In fact, this is my goofy memory of things. I don't know if you guys know where this is, but 1219 Blue Island Avenue in Chicago.
Yeah.
So if anybody's driving along there right now, I hand out to my students, I put up on an overhead the original founding document from Communist Party USA. 1219 Blue Island Avenue in Chicago, where it was founded. But Gus Hall, who ran CPUSA from 1959 to 2000, Oh, is another common thing with these people, and you know, they never give up the hold of their country or their organization. They're like dictators; they have it forever. And Gus Hall, no one ever knew how much money he was making, and our federal government knew. They kept us under tight surveillance because it would have blew the cover of the people who were infiltrating the organization. Gus pocketed millions of dollars, that subsidies from the Kremlin to Communist Party USA that he would stuff his pockets with. So this is very typical of these organizations. And when someone like Patrice Cullors says, Alicia and myself, that would be Alicia Garza, one of the other founders, we are trained Marxists. That is our worldview. We are super versed in ideological theories. We were trained in critical theory and other ideological theories. She's telling you something really significant. For the people who say, oh, well, you know, well, you're just using that to call her a Marxist and dismiss her and her organization. No, she is telling you something really important, dude, that you ought to know. And if you ignore that, you're a fool.
Well, they're calling themselves Marxists. I mean, it's like, how do you know they're Marxists? Because they tell you. It's not like they're right. Cagey about it. By the way, you'll be happy to know that the Communist Party here in Chicago is alive and thriving. So
it's
beyond Gus Hall. You wrote an interesting piece for The Spectator, too, just in terms of the unlikely foes of cancel culture. Maybe not unlikely if you think about it, but it's just sort of fun. And it's not just Johnny Rotten anymore.
No, that's right. I thought that was a lot of fun, Dan, to see this. I mean, there are a number of punk rockers who are really kind of sticking their fist, and I guess you could maybe say sticking a finger, right, at woke culture. And a number of these guys, yeah, one of them, Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols, which was a group that was around in the 1970s, 1980s.
Oh, yeah. I was in the punk rock
scene.
Yeah.
Right.
No, he was. Yeah, he had parachute pants and the whole thing.
Well, that wasn't really punk rock. That was more early...
Oh.
Early hip hop. Amy's confusing her genres. very familiar with.
But you're a break dancer.
Joy Division and Sex Pistols. Sure, go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Right, yeah, no. Yeah, mosh pits, right? Diving from the stage, mohawks. And Dan, did you have a mohawk?
I did not. I had a faux hawk.
You had a mullet.
I had a faux hawk and a mullet at the same time.
Oh, you did.
Well, yeah, you and I both shared misspent youth.
Yes, exactly. So,
I come from that whole era. The punk bar in the Pittsburgh area. I went to the University of Pittsburgh. Was called the Electric Banana.
Of course,
and
it
was.
Of course.
I don't know if you were ever there.
No, I didn't make it. Yeah, didn't make it.
Yeah. But Johnny Rotten, the Sex Pistols, I'd quote him here, but I don't know that I can say this on Salem Radio Network.
Oh,
right?
Try it. We'll bleep you.
Is it one of Carlin's? It is. No, I know. Wait. Yeah, I have seen it.
Yeah.
I've seen it. It's one of Carlin's words. You can't say it.
I'll abbreviate the four-letter word here, but Johnny Rotten, whose real name is Johnny Lydon, he referred to the wokesters as quote, tempestuous, spoiled children coming out of colleges and universities with excrement. How about that?
Yes.
For brain.
Yes. Yeah.
There you go.
I can't believe that TV stations give some of these lunatics the space. Where is this moral majority nonsense coming from when they're basically the ones doing all the wrong for being so bloody judgmental and vicious against anybody that doesn't go with a current political opinion? And he's absolutely right.
But about Anderson Cooper. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And the other one, John Joseph of the bands Blood Clot and Cro-Mags, and this is after me, so I wasn't familiar with him. But this guy says cancel culture can go, jump off of whatever themselves. They are the same ones who criticized punk rock in the 70s and hardcore in the 80s, and they will all go away soon to live their quiet lives out in desperation. Just because some of you don't agree with it, I could give a blank, stay the blank home, watch CNN and the rest. I never gave a blank what critics said in the 80s and 90s, and I still don't care now. He denounces the, quote, lying blank media and the whole cancel culture blank. So That's but these guys, it doesn't surprise me because they've always been rebels and nonconformists, and I find it ironic that liberals pride themselves in kind of, you know, hoisting themselves up there as these nonconformists. That's not true. Liberals and progressives are the ultimate conformists. They blow with the wind.
But you know
they go with whatever the zeitgeist dictates. They follow.
You know, it's interesting. I was part of a cover band for Blood Clot. We called ourselves Thrombus. So Paul, it's interesting that, you know, like you, I was, you know, as a young man trying to stick it to the man, you know, I wasn't going to be kept down in Wheaton, Illinois by the man. And that's why I was so attracted to punk. Right.
Yeah. No, same here. And so for those guys today, for people in the cancel culture to think that the guys like Joseph and Johnny Rotten would be cowered by some anonymous twits on Twitter,
exactly.
Right, who are calling
exactly.
them names. You know, these guys, they react to that by lashing out even more, right?
The guy
who wrote Anarchy in the UK, you think he's going to be pushed around by some anonymous 20-something who's saying that he's not woke? He could care less about that.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's sort of wild. I mean, Johnny Rotten, you think of Johnny Rotten in the 80s and you think like Clockwork Orange. And
right.
and now he's the responsible one, and the Ivy League educated are the droogs. I mean, it's just everything is upside down. When I never thought I'd be saying, you know, more people need to start thinking like Johnny Rotten. Never thought I'd make that statement.
Right.
Professor
right.
Paul Kanger, Professor Poli Sci, Grove City College and Grove City, PA, contributed to Spectator, author of The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception and Infiltration. Thanks, Paul.
All right. Take care, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.